Good morning. 8 a.m. having arrived, I'll call the Committee on Taxes to order. And we do not have a quorum at this time. And when we do, we'll maybe halt during a break and approve minutes and make some referrals and so forth. But today we're actually going to start a discussion on something called tax expenditures. And you know, one of the major goals of this committee is to create a tax code that is more accountable, more transparent, and more results-driven. And we have a lot of things in the tax code called tax expenditures, which basically are preferential treatments in the tax code that could otherwise be dealt through direct appropriations. And because it's a tax expenditure, it doesn't make it good or bad. There are tax expenditures that provide benefits to the poor as well as benefits to the wealthy. There's tax expenditures that are regressive. There's tax expenditures that are progressive. They help individuals, businesses, corporations. Some might be sales tax exemptions. So they're all over the place. But the reason why it's important to talk about it in tax committee here is that if you really want to get a true picture of how government spending impacts the economy and individuals and businesses, you have to understand the tax expenditures in our budget. And so I was looking through this book that comes out here from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, Tax Expenditure Budget, and I went through just the income tax part. And I was just quickly looking and just adding up the big items. And this is annual. It came to about $7.5 billion, and I know there's more. So what happens is that when you do a tax expenditure, it narrows the tax base, which means all those people who are not getting the preferential treatment sees higher taxes. And, for example, on this, if it's $7.5 billion, it's more. I calculated if you were to eliminate all those, not that I would even suggest those because, like I said, there's a lot of good ones, you could decrease and broaden your base. You could decrease your income tax rates by at least 40%. And of course in 1986 that's what President Reagan did when they did a lot of away with a lot of deductions and lowered the income tax rates by quite a bit. And so one thing we're going to be looking at in committee this year is kind of the process on tax expenditures, not so much necessarily going over each and every one, which would be impossible anyway. But tax expenditures, once they tend to get into the tax code, tend to lose the scrutiny and kind of the oversight that other spending items do. And so one thing I think we have to do is probably shed more light on tax expenditures. I know back in, I think, 2011, there was a task force that had people from all ends of the political spectrum that took a look at this and said you need to establish some sort of a system that periodically on a rotational basis looks at tax expenditures because it does have a huge impact on people one way or the other. So with that, we have a quorum. And so I knew if I talked long enough, we would get a quorum. So perfect timing. And so with that, has anyone had a chance to take a look at the January 30th minutes? Representative Carlson moves to approve the January 30th, 2019 minutes of the Tax Committee. Any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion carries. The minutes are approved. Also, in your packets, members, we have bill referrals to the Property and Local Tax Division. So it's two-sided here, but these bills here, I am referring to the Property Tax and Property and Local Tax Division. So before we go any further, we're going to have a overview from Mr. Williams on tax expenditures, and then we're going to go to Ms. Hauer from the Office of Legislative Auditor to talk about the research credit and the research and project they did a couple years ago on that. So, Mr. Williams, if you would please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Sean Williams from House Research. So I'm going to talk first by just sort of going over what the definition of a tax expenditure is. I would say that to some extent, defining a tax expenditure can be subjective because it sort of relies on an assumption about what is the normal tax baseline or the reference tax. But generally, tax expenditures are targeted or special tax reductions that deviate from the normal tax baseline. I would say that they typically are either designed to encourage taxpayers to change their behavior or to direct resources to particular groups of taxpayers. I have the definition here from the from statute that sort of is the statute establishing the requirements for the tax expenditure report. And so it defines it as a tax provision which provides a gross income definition, deduction, exemption, credit, or rate for certain persons, types of income, transactions, or property that results in reduced tax revenue. Just briefly, I want to talk about what is generally not considered a tax expenditure. So generally, features of the tax system that shift the distribution of the tax are not considered tax expenditures. So things like a family size adjustment, progressive rate structure, and standard deductions are not considered tax expenditures. Generally, constitutionally mandated provisions. So in Minnesota, we have an income tax credit for taxes paid to other states. We're constitutionally required to have that. That's not considered a tax expenditure. And then exclusions from income for practical reasons. So in Minnesota and federally, we don't tax unrealized income. So if you have a capital gain that you haven't realized by selling the asset, we don't tax that because it just would not be practical. So that's not considered a tax expenditure. So this is sort of, I think that the fundamental choice that the legislature and you as a committee face is whether or not you should use a tax expenditure to achieve a policy goal or a direct expenditure. You know, typically the goals of tax expenditure policies could also be achieved through direct expenditures. And to the extent that you're just giving money either through the tax code or through maybe a grant, an economist might say that those are equivalent policy options. But I'm going to talk about sort of some of the policy considerations that might lead you to choose one direction or the other. So the first is just the ease of administering a program. So it may be cost prohibitive to sort of operate a direct spending program that gives a small amount of money to a large number of individuals, and those individuals are already filing tax returns. So in that case, it might make a lot of sense to sort of administer the program through the tax code because those people are already filing tax returns. It just would be easier. There's some evidence that take-up is higher for programs that are administered through the tax code because, again, all people are already filing tax returns. So if you were setting up a program and considering between a direct expenditure, that might be one reason to sort of go in the direction of a tax expenditure. I would say that generally programs that require a lot of administrative discretion or technical expertise might be better administered as direct expenditure programs because the Department of Revenue is not generally staffed to make sort of technical decisions about, you know, subject matter areas or make a lot of discretion. You know, that's just not really in the core competency of the Department of Revenue. Another thing is that you might want to consider is what the behavioral effects of establishing a tax or spending program might be. Sort of a Econ 101 would tell you that it doesn't really matter what form a payment comes in, if it's a grant or a tax expenditure, that should be equivalent. But there may be behavioral economics research that indicates that tax expenditures may be more effective in some ways. Behavioral economics generally says that people are risk averse and that they value avoiding a loss greater than receiving a benefit. And so because a tax expenditure is sort of seen as, oh, I'm getting a break on my taxes, if you're a risk averse person and that's sort of baked into how you think about finance, then maybe a tax expenditure would have a stronger behavioral incentive effect. The third thing to talk about is sort of the reduction in the tax code transparency and simplicity. And Chair Marquardt, I think, talked about this a little bit already. But generally, tax expenditures make the tax code more complicated. They make it harder for the taxpayers to understand and make it harder to administer and comply with the tax code. You know, it shifts the focus of tax administrators from just collecting revenue, making sure people are filing their taxes right, to actually kind of administering these programmatic expenditures. And there's also evidence that, or there's sort of issues where taxpayers have to, in some cases, choose between different tax expenditures, which requires sort of doing complicated math on which is the better tax benefit for them, and that just makes it harder to file their tax returns. So at the federal level, you can either take the dependent care credit or put money in a dependent care account. So you'd have to do pretty complicated calculations to figure out which of those is a better tax preference for you. Or in Minnesota, we have both a 529 credit and subtraction. You can only take one of those two tax preferences For many people, it's pretty obvious which one they would take, but there's people in the phase-out for whom it's not particularly clear if they'd get a better tax benefit from the tax from the subtraction or the credit. So that's just sort of a couple examples of how it reduces this sort of simplicity and transparency of the tax code. This is related, but just in terms of tax policy goals, tax expenditures may advance some of the broad tax policy goals that are sort of generally recognized, or they may negatively affect others. So as Chair Marquardt mentioned, some tax expenditures may enhance progressivity, but as I just talked about, they generally reduce simplicity and transparency. So there's some tension in general tax policy goals. And finally, I think that, constitutional restrictions. So the courts have ruled, and this is, I'm on the very fringe of my knowledge of this topic, but the courts have generally ruled that we can't discriminate against interstate commerce in our tax code. So there's certain tax provisions that you might be able to administer as a direct spending program that you probably cannot administer as a tax expenditure. And I'm told that the courts have generally looked more favorably on grant or direct expenditure programs than tax expenditures when determining what is a sort of discrimination against interstate commerce. Lastly, I would just raise the issue of duplication with direct expenditure programs. So there are probably provisions in the tax code, and when thinking about establishing a tax expenditure, this is just a general principle to keep in mind. There may be existing direct expenditure programs that have similar goals that are targeted towards similar populations. So we have programs like CCAP in the human services area, and we have a dependent care credit in Minnesota's tax code. We have a state student loan credit to help people sort of pay for college, and we have the state grant program in the higher ed area. So to some extent, you risk duplicating direct expenditure programs. There may be reasons that if you're thinking about establishing a tax expenditure, it'd be more efficient to sort of either build on the existing direct expenditure program or maybe combine the two just to avoid duplication. I've got sort of three issues that are what I would describe as process considerations or institutional considerations about tax expenditures. The first one is just sort of the issue that Chair Marquardt mentioned of durability. So unlike spending programs, tax expenditures, if they're not, they don't include a sunset, they continue indefinitely into the future without legislative reauthorization, which means that they probably are more durable. They're probably parts of the tax code that just don't get subject to the same legislative review as they might otherwise, because unlike in an appropriations area, there's no appropriations bill every year reauthorizing them. So if the legislature does nothing, that sort of continues into the future. That might be a feature or a bug, depending on whether or not you like the tax expenditure, but it's sort of a policy consideration to think about when you're sort of deciding between these different policy tools at your disposal. There's an issue of visibility. So tax expenditures are sort of not included in the total expenditures in the state budget. So when we're adding up how much the state budget spends every year, we don't include, for example, the state dependent care credit, even though that's very similar in its structure to a direct expenditure program. So that may, again, sort of make it difficult to identify how much the state is spending on particular priorities. And again, that may be a feature or bug depending on your view of the expenditure. And lastly, there's sort of a legislative process reason that I think tax expenditures show up in committee and show up in the tax code, which is advocates for particular policy goals might think that it's useful to sort of have streams of funding alive in different committees. As we know, we're kind of siloed at the legislature. Different committees have different budget targets. And so sometimes members or advocacy groups will pursue a tax expenditure with the expectation that, well, then they'll have a bill alive in taxes and also a bill alive in human services. One last thing I wanted to talk about. So there's a requirement in state law which essentially says any bill that creates, renews, or continues a tax expenditure must include a statement of intent that clearly provides the purpose of the tax expenditure and the standard goal against which the tax expenditure's effectiveness may be measured. So I would say that this is a requirement in statute, and it's very hard to bind sort of the legislature's internal processes with statutes. But so it's not necessarily the case that every introduced bill includes one of these purpose statements. And I think that it's sort of up to the committee and the chair to some extent to determine how strict you want to be about including these purpose statements in every bill. I think historically bills that have been included in the omnibus tax bill and provisions included in the omnibus tax bill have come along with these purpose statements, and that's something that legislative staff can work with you to help draft, and you know, you as a member, if you're introducing a bill, could you know, work on. There's a few additional resources that if you really want to dig in on this, Chair Marquardt mentioned the tax expenditure budget. That's an annually published report that sort of shows how much the state is spending in different tax expenditures. That's a long report. It's very detailed, and it sort of itemizes every single tax expenditure in the budget. And then Chair Marquardt also mentioned in 2011 there's a tax expenditure review, which was sort of a systematic review of the existing tax expenditures. An evaluation of, you know, whether or not it was, you know, consistent with good tax policy goals to continue them. House Research in 2013 also did a quite long, I think it's 150-page review of tax expenditures. So that's all available on our website, and I'm happy to provide you with paper or PDF copies at your request. I also wanted to plug just yesterday, I think this might be Joel Michaels' last publication for House Research, but we released a publication on tax expenditures versus direct expenditures. It's a primer, so it talks in a little bit more detail about sort of reasons, policy reasons you might go in one direction or the other to sort of either pursue a tax expenditure or a direct expenditure. And I brought some copies of that, so you could flag me down after committee if you want a copy.
Mr. Williams, thank you so much. I'll take a couple questions if anyone has a couple questions right now. Otherwise, Representative Carlson.
One thing, Mr. Chairman, comes to mind, maybe it's more a comment than a question, but I'll just pick up on Mr. Williams' the state grant program versus the tax deduction direct expenditure tax side. If you want to create a system, whether how many losers then, if you were to go one way or the other, it takes some coordination with, for example, in that case, the Higher Education Committee, which is responsible for state grants. Just a comment that internally there may be some complications if we wanted to simplify some of those things, but to do it in a way that we make sure that there aren't taxpayers that end up on the losing side unexpectedly.
Mr. Williams?
Yes,
exactly.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, and I think that if you looked closely at the individuals that benefit from the student loan credit versus the state grant program, they may be serving different populations of people at different times in their lives. So if we were to just do away with the tax credit for student loans, that obviously would probably hurt people that are finished with college. And if you put that into the state grant program particularly, that would help people currently in college. So these programs are sort of substantively designed to achieve the same policy goal, but might be helping people at different points in their lives. But there's probably people that will benefit from both and some duplication that occurs as well.
Represent Carlson.
There would need to be some coordination of how those kinds of things.
Yeah, good point. All right. Mr. Williams, thank you so much for that overview. And And today we have Jody Hauer from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Ms. Hauer, welcome to the committee. And so what I would like, if you could, there's portions where I think you have breaks, probably. So members, let's hold our questions. I talked with Ms. Hauer ahead of time, and kind of when you get to a break point, if you would just kind of mention that, and then members, kind of hold your questions till then. So it won't be till the very end, but kind of we'll break this up a little bit so you can keep your flow going, but also of the presentation, but also we have time for questions too. So, Ms. Hauer, please proceed. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm very glad to be here today to talk with you about our Minnesota Research Tax Credit evaluation. We released this 2 years ago, and so I'll be talking about this somewhat in the past tense because it is 2 years old. The data have not been updated since then, but I think that the findings and the conclusions that we reached are still relevant despite the fact that it's 2 years past. What I'm planning to do, Mr. Chair and members, is give a quick overview of the conclusions we reached. Then I want to provide some background about the Minnesota Research Tax Credit, and then I'll follow that up with a bit more detail on the major findings and the recommendations that we have in this report. So first, evaluating the effectiveness of the Research Tax Credit requires knowing what is that credit's purpose. But Minnesota statutes do not include a purpose for the tax credit. Second, we did estimate that Minnesota's research tax credit did increase jobs and increase employee earnings. However, the amount of the increase was rather small, and the tax credit does not pay for itself. Now, when the legislature, at least in the past, has discussed possible changes to the tax or to the research tax credit, the Department of Revenue has prepared estimates of what the impacts would be, what the fiscal impacts would be on the state's general fund. And of course, that's good and important information. However, the state does not analyze whether any of these proposed changes would impact the effectiveness of the tax credit. So the Department of Revenue has data on the research tax credit, as you might guess, but the data that it collects is insufficient to conduct a full evaluation of the research tax credit. The department has a process, of course, for auditing tax returns, including those that are part of the research tax credit, but we determined that that can increase the administrative burden for certain taxpayers. And finally, the department did provide guidance to help taxpayers with the research tax credit, but we found that that guidance was limited. So with that, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to give you some background information, and then I'll go back into detail on the main findings that I just presented very briefly. So first, it was the 1981 legislature that established Minnesota's research tax credit, and that made Minnesota the very first state to have a research tax credit. There are three types of businesses that are currently eligible to claim the research tax credit. The first are the S corporations, and as many of you will know, those are rather small domestic business corporations. They have fewer than 100 shareholders, and they meet certain other legal requirements that pertain to those shareholders, like the tax status of their shareholders. But that's one group that's eligible. The second group is the C corporations. Now, the C corporations are every corporation except the S corporations. And then the third group that's eligible are the partnerships. And again, you probably know partnerships are the syndicates or unincorporated organizations through which partners come together to carry on whatever business it is they're transacting. Now, for the partners in the partnerships and the shareholders in the S corporations, the research tax credit is allocated to those individual partners and those individual shareholders. Now, by contrast, for the C corporations, the tax credit goes to the corporation itself, so it's the entity that claims the tax credit. To be eligible for Minnesota's research tax credit, a company's research has to satisfy all components of a four-part test. Now, it's somewhat complicated. I don't really need to go into it today for reasons of timing, and also because our conclusions would remain the same. But I do want to point out that in the full report, which all of you should have, if you are interested in those four tests, they're based on Internal Revenue Service code, and they are on page 6 of the full report if you care to look at those. But I'm going to talk more about the Minnesota's research tax credit formula. We do have a fairly complicated formula in Minnesota. Again, I don't feel it's necessary this morning to go through that in detail, although I can answer questions if you have any. I do want to point out that we do in detail explain that in that first chapter, page 7 in that report, and we also have give a step-by-step explanation of the process for calculating the research tax credit for a hypothetical business. So that's also on page 8. But for today, I'm going to talk more about the formula in simpler terms, just so you have a basic understanding. So the formula accounts for a company's what's called qualified research expenses, and we'll get into that more in just a minute. But they look at the qualified research expenses for the current year and then compare that against a base amount of past expenses for that corporation and company sales. So those are the key factors involved. Now, the credit itself has two tiers of tax credit rates. And this little table on the slide shows that the first tier has a 10% rate that's applied against the first $2 million worth of qualified expenses. And the second tier now has a 4% rate applied against qualified research expenses. I do want to point out, when we did this evaluation and released it 2 years ago, that second tier rate was actually at 2.5%, but the 2017 legislature increased that from 2.5% up to 4%, and that's where it stands today. So businesses have to complete research here in Minnesota if they're going to be eligible for the research tax credit, and only research of certain types is eligible for the credit. So I'm going to explain here what those major types are. So the eligible expenses, most of them, 65%, as you can see on this particular slide, went to pay for the employee researchers that were employed by the businesses that did the research. And that, of course, is the largest segment of the qualified research expenses for the C corporations. This slide and several others look only at the C corporations because they are the main claimants, and data were not available for the individual, either the partners or the shareholders. So this is just the C corporations. But so we looked at a period of 2010 through 2014 expenses, and about, as I said, or sorry, this is in, for the wages, it was 76% made up the eligible research. Then other eligible research, about 14% was research supplies. And then another expense was the percentage of contract costs that a company had to pay to others who did research on behalf of that company. And that component was about 10% of total eligible expenses. And then the remaining categories were just added up to less than, or about 1% of total eligible research. Now I'm going to move on to sort of who is claiming the credit and how much are we as a state providing to the claimants. This first slide shows to you the amount of the research tax credit that has been claimed over a period of time. Each column here obviously represents 1 year. The lower segment in each column is a darker color. That represents the C corporations. So these are the largest corporations. And I do want to call your attention to the three tallest of the columns. So I'm looking at years 2010, 2011, and 2012. In those 3 years, Minnesota's research tax credit was refundable. And what that means, refundability means that if a company claimed the credit and the credit was larger than the tax liability, we as a state would provide a refund to that corporation. Now you can see that lasted just 3 years. So those 3 years were the only ones, and then in 2013, by 2013, that had gone away. See, if you look from 2009 to 2010, a very large increase in the number of claimants, or excuse me, the amount of the research tax credit that was claimed, and that is due, we think, at least in some part, to the fact that the tax credit became refundable. But so for those C corporations, the amount of credit tripled, really, between 2009 and 2010. But there were two other law changes in 2010 that contributed to this dramatic growth that you can see in the 2010 year. One is that the legislature increased the tax credit rate on that first tier. As I said earlier, it's now 10%. It had been 5%. So that doubling of the tax credit rate probably was an incentive to more corporations to apply for the credit, and of course you can see that the amount of the credit claimed really did jump. Then the second change in 2010 was that the legislature expanded eligibility. So in 2010, that was the first year that the individual partners and the individual shareholders in their respective partnership or S corporation were eligible for the tax credit. So you'll see as you look at the top segment of each of these columns from 2010 forward, there's a lighter colored teal. That represents those individual partners and shareholders. And again, you can see that the amount of the credit, the large amount, the bulk of the amount, was for the C corporations, but those individual taxpayers also did did claim some. The last thing I'll point out on this slide is that in 2013, so that's the year after refundability went away, you can see that the amount of the research tax credit claimed diminished considerably. So the next slide shows the number of claimants. So here we're looking at the top segment of each of these columns represents those individual partners and shareholders. And the bottom darker color shade is the C corporations. Again, you can see the growth in the number of claimants in those years when refundability was in effect, 2010 to 2012. And then it dropped off a bit in the following years when refundability went away. Now, as part of our evaluation 2 years ago when we were doing the research, we conducted a survey of businesses that had claimed the research tax credit for a period of 3 years, 2012, 2013, or 2014. And we asked them a number of questions. One of them was, where do you conduct your research and your development? And about 73% of the survey respondents indicated that the most of their research and development occurred in the seven-county metropolitan area, which this map depicts. Hennepin County alone accounted for 40% of the research and development activity for these corporations that had claimed the credit. So who are the industries that are claiming the credit? So we looked at the industrial sectors of the C corporations to see who was claiming the credit. And you can see from this slide that about two-thirds, 65% of those who were claiming the credit were in the manufacturing sector. That was an average over about 6 years of data. We looked at the tax credit claimants by size of the corporation. And this slide shows that, and again, this is just the C corporations here. Same data were not available for the individual partners or shareholders, so think of this as just the C corporations. But among those C corporations, if you look at just the top 20%, the top 20% in terms of size, they claimed two-thirds of the credit. So most of the tax credit, two-thirds of it, went to the very largest of the C corporations in the state. By contrast, that small sliver on this pie, that's the smallest 20% of the C corporations, they received about 4% of the tax credit. Mr. Chair, at this point, that's the background information. I could stop here if anyone has questions on that, or I could proceed with the findings.
That would be great. And also, using the research of Representative Carlson, back in 1981, when the research tax credit was established, Irv Anderson was the tax chair. So are there any questions at this point for Ms. Hauer? All right. Not? Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we began the evaluation, so we were doing the evaluation in 2015, we had hoped to produce a report that would indicate, well, how well is this research tax credit achieving its objectives, achieving its purpose. But as I mentioned at the outset, Minnesota statutes do not specify a purpose for the research tax credit, nor have we as a state established ways to measure how well that tax credit, research tax credit, is working. Now, Sean Williams did refer to this, and we knew that there was a law in place that requires purpose statements and measurable objectives for tax expenditures, but that applied to those enacted after July of 2010. So it did not apply to the research tax credit. We do recommend that the legislature establish in statute explicit and measurable objectives for the research tax credit. Some other states have done this. We do give some examples in our report, especially one from Washington State, which does require performance statements and requires certain metrics for its tax incentives, not just the research tax credit, but all of their tax incentives. So despite the fact that the research tax credit lacks a statutory purpose, we did make some assumptions about the likely purposes and likely objectives of the research tax credit. And one of those, of course, is the objective of creating or retaining jobs. So we used an economic model that had been developed by the Pew Charitable Trusts to estimate the effects of Minnesota's research tax credit on job creation and the state economy from 2008 through 2014. Now, again, this analysis included only the C corporations because data we needed to do this analysis were not available for the individual partners or shareholders. So recognize that these next few slides will be just relevant for the C corporations, but of course they make up the bulk of the amount of the tax credit that's claimed. By the way, I would like to point out that we do, I don't have with me today, but we have online at the OLA's website an appendix that does lay out with great detail this particular economic tool that we use. So should anybody be interested, you could see the factors that go into it and how we used it. So the results of the analysis using this economic tool are laid out in this table. We did estimate that Minnesota's research tax credit increased jobs and earnings from 2008 to 2014. And they're displayed here in this particular table. Now look at that column that's called net increase in employment. You can see that the jobs due to the research tax credit increased from 790 in 2008 up to over 1,500. Now this is, the count here is in a job year, so that means one job for a single year. So there were 790 job years in 2008 that increased over 1,500 job years by 2014. I want to point out that the estimate of job years include the direct jobs, those people who were hired by the incentivized companies, the companies that claim the tax credit, but it also includes the indirect jobs. Those are jobs that are out there by the suppliers who supply equipment and other services to the incentivized companies, the companies that receive the tax credit. And then the estimates also include what are called induced jobs. And the induced jobs are created when the employees receive higher wages and they spend them in the grocery stores and other services and goods in the local economy. So the estimates do take those various types of jobs into account in the record that you see in this particular slide. I'll point now to the final column here, which is the earnings. That's employee earnings, and it includes both salary and benefits. You do see increases there, of course, from $43 million of increase in earnings in 2008, and that increased to $129 million in 2014. Now, to give these estimates some kind of meaning, we wanted to place them in some greater context to help understand, okay, so what does that mean for us as a state? So we compared the jobs and the earnings growth due to the tax credit, the research tax credit, with statewide growth in jobs and in earnings. And what we found is that the annual jobs and earnings attributable to the research tax credit were a very small percentage. In fact, they amounted to about 0.06 of a percent of the statewide growth in jobs and earnings from 2008 to 2014. We then thought it would be good to look at just those four industries that make up the largest percentage or share of the corporations that do account for the research tax credit. And so we looked at those four account for 95% of the credit that's claimed. And for them, we saw that the jobs and earnings attributable to the research tax credit represented at most 0.2% of the growth in jobs and earnings in these four industry sectors over the five-year period we're looking at. Another way to look at the effect of the tax credit is on this next slide, and let me take a moment to explain it. The economic model that we used allowed us to compare the statewide fiscal benefits of that research tax credit against the amount of the credit that was claimed. So we found that those statewide net fiscal benefits offset only a portion of the costs of the credit. Now, when I talk about net fiscal benefits, I'm referring to the increased number of jobs, the increased amount of earnings that were statewide due specifically to the research tax credit, offset by increases in costs, additional public spending that is necessary to accommodate the population growth that normally occurs when there is job creation. So for this particular chart, I want to point you just to first here, the final point, which is 2014, to explain what this chart is telling us. If you look at 2014, we had estimated that in that year, the net fiscal benefit to the state of the research tax credit was $7.2 million, and the amount of the credit claimed was over $32 million. So what that represents is the net fiscal benefits offset about 22% of the tax credits that were claimed in 2014. The last thing I'll point out in this particular slide, again, if you look at those years, 2010, 11, and 12, those were the 3 years when refundability was in place. And, of course, you can see that the offset was much lower there, between 5 and 8%. And we believe that that's because of the dramatically larger amount of tax credit claimed in those 3 years when the credit was refundable.
So, Ms. Hauer,
yes.
Just explain the net fiscal benefit again. What does that all include? Does it include the new jobs, the new salaries? Does it include outside sales that would have been generated from this research, from other businesses and so forth? What does it all include?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The net fiscal benefits are the increase in jobs and increase in earnings, and that is offset by a subtraction of increased public spending needed to accommodate public services due to increased population that comes about when there's job creation. So, for instance, you know, the school district, if there's an influx of 100 new families and the school district has to hire, whatever, 3 new teachers, whatever it might be, there's an increase in public spending. And so this model that we used subtracts an amount out of that to reflect the increased public spending that naturally occurs when there is significant job creation. So the net fiscal benefit is looking at the increase in jobs, the increase in earnings, subtracting out, though, the increase in the natural increase in public spending that would occur.
Okay. Representative, thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to testify, thank you for this detailed report. I want to go back to 13 and 14, those tables. I'm still a little bit unclear whether or not they actually are saying the same thing. In looking at the job creation and earnings increases, it seems that from 2008 to 2014, the amount of jobs created doubled approximately, but the net earnings tripled. And so it seems to me that that would make the program starting to work better. And is that the reason why it's reflected for going from 18% to 22% or not? And then 14 says that it was a very small percentage, and yet a small percentage growth in each one is comparable. So is there really I guess I'm just trying to figure out exactly how that works.
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you're right that the percentage growth was small, but it represented a very minute amount of the overall growth in the state. I'm not sure if that answers everything that you were asking.
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair, it just seems like when talking about that the tax credit isn't, I mean, it seems like there's an implication the tax credit isn't really working the way it was, and certainly there's a larger investment than what the results we're seeing. But chart 13 indicates that at least in the net increase in earnings is outpacing the growth in jobs, which would mean that that's at least in a positive direction. Am I correct in that assumption?
Ms. Fowler.
Mr. Chair and Representative, a good point, and thanks. You did mention that, and I didn't address it. Yes, certainly there was a greater increase in the earnings. I think that reflects a couple of things. One is that many of the employees who are employed in corporations that are doing research and development are higher-paid employees. We're not talking about the lower-paid employees here as much as we are some fairly high paid employees. So we would expect to see a greater amount of increase among the employee earnings than we would perhaps in the number of jobs. So I think that the larger increase in earnings does reflect the fact that those hired tend to be scientists and others that are higher paid employees.
Representative Petersburg.
Okay, so I kind of was, I jumped a little bit of gun there. I was assuming the net increase in earnings was corporate earnings instead of individual earnings, and so that's a little bit of my confusion. I apologize for that. Thank you. Thank you.
Very good. Representative McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question regarding the how many, if at all, qualify for this credit, the R&D credit, and or the angel investment credit? Is there a possibility that all three could apply to a new startup or be eligible for those? And then in the second part of that question is how many, if are either minority-owned or women-owned businesses or operate in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can't answer how many of them who are qualified to claim the credit also were part of the Angel Investment Credit. As I understand it, that program no longer exists. I know that it was still in place, I think, as we did a research, but it was, I think, phased out the year that this released, or I might be 1 or 2 years off. I'm sorry, would you tell me the second question again, please?
Second part was, if in your research or your audit, how many were that qualified for either all three or at this point, since the Angel Fund credit has expired, that were either minority-owned, women-owned, or in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for repeating that. We don't have data on the number of these corporations that were minority-owned or women-owned. We do, though, have information, not in the particular report here, but I could get it for you if you want it, in terms of where those companies were located. What we looked at, though, was where they actually conducted their research, because that was the piece of it that was most important and relevant to this evaluation. So I am certainly willing to, if you're interested in knowing where, I mean, I think you're asking, like, where was the home company? Because obviously for a large corporation, a company could be located anywhere in the state, but they might be conducting their research in a completely different part of the state. And so we were looking at where that research was conducted as opposed to where the parent company was located. But I think you're asking, where was the parent company located? Is that correct?
So it Representative McDonald, is that?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay. So, Ms. Hauer, if you could provide that at some point, that would be much appreciated. Mr. Klayman, anything on the question on Angel Investment Credit and also the R&D credit?
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Williams and I were just conferring. I think we'd want to go back and just look at the statutes again to be sure. But one, I guess, point I'd make on that is that the Angel Investment Credit applies to the investors who, you know, invest, who are qualified investors for that credit, whereas the R&D credit, and so then the investors would be the ones taking the credit, whereas for the R&D credit, it would either be the entity or the shareholders who own the business who would take the credit. But we can follow up on that and get back to the committee.
Thank you. Anything further, Representative McDonald? Representative Swiecinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of looking back at slide 15, so you've got the seven, the other members already talked a little bit about that, just kind of that seems like maybe we're not quite pushing. Is there any been a look back from the research to say, okay, so even though 5% or 15% 2009 from a fiscal net benefit, have you looked back to see, okay, what has that research, maybe growth, you know, from a 5 or 6 or 7 year look back? Rather, you know, is this research that you did with through this, is this looking back from today and saying that dollar only created that much of economic benefit? Or was that kind of with the time, you took a time slot and said, okay, this time period, we invested $1 million, but maybe only got $300,000 of economic benefit back out of it within this period of time, or have we kind of looked from the forward to the back to see kind of a long-term change with that research? And I have a follow-up.
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we looked at this at annual points in time. So I think you're thinking of when you're saying a look back. Well, we looked back, but it was not like over that whole period. It was looking at for each year, this was the amount of tax credit claimed, this was the amount of benefit, net fiscal benefit that had been accrued.
Does certainly.
Representative Swiecinski.
Well, that makes more sense. I mean, I think that's probably what we're looking at is, you know, you're looking kind of at a snapshot in time when you're spending the dollar and that dollar return. You know, when you're dealing with research, oftentimes it takes time for that, whether you get to market or you that becomes from an idea the market to actual to consumption. And then my second question was, some of that economic development, did we see outside state firms decide, okay, you know, let's say they were located in Hudson, Wisconsin, but they decided to do the research in Minneapolis. Did we see any of that crossover? Were these Minnesota firms only that, you know, decided to do their research?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, if I could just consult for a moment with my colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I could not remember the answer, but I'm told by my colleagues who helped me out with this research project that a company could be located anywhere else. They wouldn't have to be located here in Minnesota. It's just that the research they conducted had to be here in Minnesota.
Very good. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on number 13. I'm not really familiar with job years, and I wonder if you can just tell me a little bit more about that. Is this kind of similar to Representative Swedzinski's question? Is it like you take a look at that singular year in 2008, there were 790 people employed for that year that can be like attributed to this, or does that sort of include like a projection like out further, like of a job that might be created or sustained by this investment? Basically, I'm wondering, like, how many people does this represent? Is this actually like 800 people, 790 people, or is that just like
Ms. Howard?
You know.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, and it's the job year term is not one that people commonly use, but it is a single job in a given single year. So those 790 do represent people who were employed for a year as a result of the research tax credit. Now, some of those 790 could be part of, no, it wouldn't be. I misspoke, because each of these represent an increase in the number of employees per year. So the 870 in 2009, which is the next row in this table, that accounts for an increase of that number of jobs per year in that given year. And that would be true down the row, each row that we list here through 2014.
Okay, thank you. And
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you talked about direct versus induced jobs.
Yes.
And so is the sort of idea of an induced job like something that comes about because of the spending of somebody who is in a direct job position? Or can you explain that difference to me, please?
Ms. Hauer.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, you've got it right. So the direct jobs are those that are hired by the companies that are getting the research tax credit. Indirect jobs are those that are people hired by the supplying companies, people that supply the incentivized companies, those getting the tax credit, with equipment, supplies, etc. And then the induced jobs are those where people who are now earning more money because of the research tax credit can spend that more money, spend that additional money in their local economies. So the induced jobs is an estimate of how many additional jobs were created because more money is flowing through the local economy due to the research tax credit that allowed the additional hires and the additional wages.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then I guess I'm interested in like what the sort of proportion is of direct versus induced jobs. And then I'm just trying to kind of think through like, this net increase in earnings, which are employee earnings in the second column or third column or whatever. So if that includes, you're talking about the impact that consumer spending has on a local economy, and in terms of the, wages that go to an individual, like the research scientist versus the person working in a service industry job, that those dollars, that they create this sort of induced job. I'm just sort of trying to think through like what is the actual economic benefit, who's getting that benefit in, and as we're looking at these indicators, like we can talk about induced jobs, but like the person who is working in the service industry at a grocery store in a restaurant where this like that sort of is spurred by this consumer spending, it's not like they're not getting a big proportion of this $129 million, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, if I could have just a moment.
Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I'm not going to be able to answer your question today, but we're going to go back and look at the economic model and see if we can determine what those proportions are. I think your intuition is correct that the largest effect is going to certainly come from those direct jobs, because those are going to be the higher paid employees, and those are the ones that, you know, well, it just seems likely that your intuition is correct. But we're going to go back and see if we can tell from the model whether we can kind of whittle down to see what the proportion of that net fiscal benefit was attributable to direct, indirect, or induced jobs.
Okay, and but that
Representative Gomez.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, but that column, the increase in earnings does include earnings for an employee in an induced job.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, you're correct.
Okay. Yeah, because
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, to Representative Swadzinski's point, I'm interested just in looking at the, you know, it basically like less than doubled the increase in employment in job years, less than doubled, you know, roughly from 08 to 14, but the increase in earnings almost tripled. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering what kind of accounts for that. So, but I'm happy to talk more about it later. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You got Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hopefully this is an easier question. I'm just wondering if when we count that number of jobs, are those full-time employees?
Full-time equivalents.
Well, FTEs.
Ms. Hauer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative. Think of it, when you think of a job year, it's one job for 1 year. So if you think of 2,080 hours per year is usually a full-time person, so that 790, if they were all working full-time, that would be 790 people. But if some of them were part-time, like half a year, then that would not be a head count. It would reflect that part-time employee who only worked part of the time.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, 790, that number in this chart, three people, you know, four people working 25% of that time would count as four in the 790 number?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, Howard. Yes, that would be a job year because they worked in a job for a year.
Yeah. Let's clarify this. I think if you had four working a quarter, it would count as one job on that chart. Is that correct, Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you. Ms. Howard, please. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, on slide 14, it talks about the four industries. And if I've missed the four industries, and I kind of flipped through the book, I didn't find it. Can you tell me what the four industries are, please?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, thanks for asking. So the first is the manufacturing industry, which is we talked about earlier being the largest claimant for the research tax credit. The second is the professional, scientific, and technical services industry. The third is management of companies and enterprises industry, and then the fourth was wholesale trade industry. So those were the four industrial sectors that were the bulk of the claimants.
Representative Fabian, anything?
No, that's good, thank you.
Very good. Ms. Hauer, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we learned about some of the circumstances that exist when changes are proposed to the research tax credit, and I want to talk about some of that now. First, the national literature that we examined as a part of this evaluation recommends that when states are discussing changes to their tax expenditures, that they first understand, you know, what's the fiscal risk of the proposed change to that tax expenditure. That only makes sense. But they also say that states should try to understand how that proposed change would affect the effectiveness or the impact of that tax incentive. So in Minnesota, the Minnesota Department of Revenue, when legislators are discussing proposals to change the tax credit, the Department of Revenue would put together estimates of what the impact those changes would have on the state's general fund. But legislators do not have information on to what degree the changes might improve the impact or the effectiveness of the research tax credit. But we recommend that the legislature require analyses of how well changes to the tax credit actually help achieve the credit's purpose. And this can be done in a number of ways, but we think it can be boiled down to two major steps. The first is that it would require a third party to analyze the changes to the tax credit. Now, that could be the Department of Revenue, it could be a contract organization or somebody else, but we think that it would include identifying what data are needed to monitor what the effectiveness is of the change in the credit, as well as determining how you're going to collect that data and how you're going to analyze it. Then the second major step would be having the legislature take a review of the tax credit sometime, maybe a couple of years after that change was implemented. So one way to do that might be to add a sunset provision to the law when it's amended that would require the legislature to come back a few years later or whatever time interval you think is appropriate to either reapprove that credit with its change or to make adjustments as necessary. And we think the results of looking at the effectiveness of the credit in the intervening years would allow legislators to make an informed decision about whether they think, yes, the impact is worthwhile, or no, it should be altered. So when changing the research tax credit, we also suggest that the legislature consider ways to structure changes in the ways that could help control costs to the state. So this would include things like targeting the credit to those businesses that are best suited to achieve whatever goal we're hoping to attain with this tax credit and any change to it. Another possibility would be to control the cost by capping the amount of the credit that could be claimed. Right now, there isn't a cap in Minnesota. A third would be to link the proposed change to the credit to companies' actual performance. And I'm talking about here designing the change in a way that would make receipt of the credit contingent upon evidence that the company actually met the objective. One example would be if you're targeting a change to startup businesses, this particular limit or linking would require the claimant to provide evidence that they hired the additional research scientists or other employees if the objective is to help out startup businesses increase or retain employees. So we think that those are some examples of ways to help control the costs to the state that could be built in if additional changes are being made to the research tax credit. I'm going to talk briefly about some of the data issues that we discovered when we were doing the evaluation. So we concluded that the Department of Revenue's research tax credit data is not sufficient to allow a full evaluation of the credit's performance. Now, I want to make it clear that the department does not have a legal obligation to evaluate the effectiveness of the tax credit. So what it does is collect the data it needs to do its job, and the Department of Revenue's job is to administer the assessment and the collection of taxes. So it collects the data it needs for that. It does not, though, collect the kind of data that would be useful to be able to evaluate the full impact of the tax credit across the state. So this means that the department does not have data to analyze all the taxpayers that claim the credit. And I'm talking specifically here about those individuals, the shareholders and the partners. We did not have the data. We don't know what kind of impact when I talked about the various impacts in these last few slides, we don't know what impact was created by the individual partners or shareholders. In addition, the department did not have updated data on tax credit amounts. Tax credit amounts can change if a corporation amends its tax return or if there's an audit and it results in a change in the amount of the tax credit. But the data were not available to us to know what kind of effects that those kinds of changes might have had. So we recommend that the legislature authorize and then require the Minnesota Department of Revenue to collect and maintain data that would be sufficient to allow periodic evaluations of the research tax credit. We don't think it has to be done every year, although the data would have to be collected yearly. And we think that would help not our office necessarily, but anybody who might be called upon to, in the future, try to ascertain what is the impact of the tax credit across all of the recipients of the credit.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Howard, the slide 18, your third bullet point there linked the tax credit to actual performance of the claimant.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving forward to slide 19, where the department would collect data and so forth. Two things. Now, obviously, there would be a cost in collecting the data, but more importantly, then if you go back to slide 13, would that then allow us to change that slide to from estimated job creation and earning increases to more hard numbers, more hard data? Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, you're right. There's definitely a cost to collecting and maintaining the data. There would also be a cost to whatever third party is used, whether it's the department or some other independent contractor, to analyze the data. In terms of your reference to the chart on slide 13, what we would be able to do is look at the add into those estimates any impact from the partnerships and the S corporations, because right now they're not included in this chart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative McDonald.
Actually, I could ask the question when she's finished, if
okay.
That's right.
That sounds good. Great. Representative, you want? No? Representative Swiecinski.
Well, mine's kind of just a follow-up to what Representative Fabian had to say, Chair Marquardt. But do we have any data? So if we were to that third point on number 18, link the tax credit to actual performance of the claimants, do we have any data on the length of research? So the time period in which so let's say in 2018 someone's going to receive the tax credit. Do we have any data on the length of time in which the research is actually taking place? Because that would have a direct relation to when they could actually receive it. So let's say it began in 18, ends in 2022. You know, and then at that point in time, they'd actually receive the tax credit. Because if you tie it to results, you don't know research until the research is complete.
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I understand your point, but you don't have to have the research complete in order to get the credit. The research is underway, and while the research is underway, the claims for the research tax credit come in. So we'd be looking only at a specific, you know, point in time for those.
Very good. Please proceed.
Okay. I'm getting near the end, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk briefly about the audits that the Department of Revenue conducts. And that's, of course, an important part of the department's oversight function is to audit tax returns, including those that might have research tax credit involved. By way of background, I want you to know that the department does not audit returns for the sole purpose of the research tax credit. They tend to look at the tax return more holistically, and they'll look for any area of noncompliance. And so it might include the research tax credit, but that's not going to be the main reason necessarily that the audit is undertaken. So I mentioned earlier that we had surveyed companies as a part of evaluation, and we'd asked them a number of questions about various things. And one of them was to ask if you received an audit, was it completed, and then if it was, what was the experience like for you? Well, kind of surprisingly, we got a mixed result, but kind of surprisingly, at least to me, about 38% of those who responded and had undergone an audit, they had described their experience as positive. And even a couple of them said very positive, which, you know, I don't know that I had expected that, but a couple of the explanations that accompanied their responses showed why they said that. One of them in particular said that the auditor had helped the company identify what errors it was making in its calculation of the tax credit, and it helped them move forward in the process of tax credit, research tax credit claims. And they said that from that point on, their process was so much smoother because the auditor had helped them really understand, well, this is what you have to do in order to make the calculation. Now, at the same time, there were about 32% of those who we had surveyed and had been audited reporting a negative or very negative experience. And I'll just briefly talk about some of the frustrations that these companies expressed to us. I mean, one was the length of the audits. And they can take many months. We did, during the evaluation, look at a sample of the audits that had included research tax credit as part of the audit. and the average age was slightly over a year, so that takes a lot of time. The longest one was more than 2 years. So, and I should explain that the length of the audit was not just the pieces related to the research tax credit. It was that holistic looking at every point that might be out of compliance. Another frustration was the cost of complying with the audit. There were a couple who responded that the cost to them to go through the audit was greater than the amount of credit that they had received. And then the third frustration was that what some taxpayers had considered to be kind of unreasonable requests for information. And one example that came up more than once was that the auditor had required information that the company felt it had already provided to that auditor or a different auditor earlier. And so for them, it was kind of a frustration that they would hope to avoid in the future. Now, we looked at information that the Department of Revenue offered to taxpayers regarding the research tax credit. We found that the Department of Revenue did offer guidance, but it was limited. And there were questions about whether taxpayers really could understand what they needed to document in order to substantiate their claim for the tax credit. So we recommended that the Department of Revenue provide additional information and more specific information to help the taxpayers who are claiming the research tax credit know what kind of documentation they need if they're going to substantiate their claim. The last thing that I'll talk about, Mr. Chair and members, has to do with a comparison we made of Minnesota's research tax credit with other states. We looked at a sample of five other states. So these were California, Iowa, Massachusetts, Washington State, and Wisconsin. So we looked at various factors of these different states' parameters for their research tax credits, and we saw a lot of differences from state to state. So one of the things that people like to point out is that, oh, the tax credit rate in this state is so much higher than it is in this other state. Well, the tax credit rate, of course, is very important, but by itself, it really doesn't give you a complete picture of what the tax credit can do for a company. So I wanted to give some examples of, I'm going to jump the gun a little bit on my slide here, but I wanted to talk about a couple of examples where we saw differences in how the tax credit was structured from state to state. So for instance, some states have caps on the amount of tax credit that can be claimed. Some states still do offer refundability. I already mentioned that we had that in place for 3 years, but it went away in Minnesota. But Iowa is one that still offers it, or did back when we were doing this research. Some states, including California, require that companies who are deducting their research expenses use a lower rate in making their calculations of the tax credit than they would otherwise. So the next point that's already up on my slide here has to do with a comparison that we made of hypothetical companies in each of these six states, including Minnesota, and what kind of credit would be generated for those hypothetical companies. So we looked at a small size, a medium size, and a large size company, and then we calculated what kind of research tax credit they might expect if they were in these other states. And what we found is that a small hypothetical company located here in Minnesota would generate as much or more tax credit than it would in all but one of the other states, and a medium-sized company here in Minnesota would generate at least as much or more tax credit than all of the other five states we compared. Now, by contrast, the large hypothetical company resulted that it would actually receive less research tax credit in Minnesota than it would in any of the five other states that we compared. Again, we have more detail on this in the full report if anybody is interested. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my remarks. The final slide is just the recommendations I've already covered, so this is just a summary of the recommendations that we had made in the report itself. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hauer. And before we go to questions, Mr. Williams and Mr. Clayman have an answer to Representative McDonald's angel tax credit. So
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I took a look at some of the statutes we have here, and there's no specific prohibition on a taxpayer taking both the R&D credit and the angel credit. However, there probably wouldn't be too much crossover because the two tax credit programs are aimed at really separate populations of taxpayers and businesses. So, for instance, under the angel investment credit, only qualified investors can take the credit, and those qualified investors have to be either natural-born persons, which excludes C corporations, or a pass-through entity that is certified as a qualified fund, whereas for the research credit, the C-Corps and the pass-through entities, they can take the research credit. So the and then the other limitation on the angel investment credit side is that those investments cannot be made in a publicly traded corporation, in a publicly traded business for the angel investment credit. So really the only overlap might be within those pass-through entities that could both take the research credit and also be a qualified fund to take the angel investment credit. There are also some other limitations on the businesses that you can invest in under the angel investment credit. So, for instance, they have to be headquartered in Minnesota, have fewer than 25 employees, less than 10 or in some cases 20 years in business, and again, not publicly traded, have not had any prior private equity investments. So the population of those businesses where there be a crossover are probably fairly limited.
So, Representative McDonald, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, follow up to that, is it possible then these businesses also can get the federal federal tax credit as well? The federal government, they enacted a similar policy. Matter of fact, Minnesota's, according to the audit, Minnesota adopted ours after the federal program. So can they piggyback?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes. So there's nothing to prevent a taxpayer who receives the Minnesota R&D credit from also getting the federal credit.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. So with that said, the intent is grand. I think we can all agree to attract new businesses and retain jobs and increase the strength fiscally here in our state. But it is evident that it's not necessarily doing that. So is it an intent of the chair and this committee to do and take the requirements of the OLA? This is from 2017. I certainly hasn't picked up the mantle in the years that I've been here. But perhaps the money would be better spent giving back to families and businesses, helping with the disabled or the PCA, personal care assistants, who are paid such little money. So I think that's something that this committee is looking at. It is your intent then, Mr. Chair, to actually adopt some of the principles? Should we draft some bills to suggest the Department of Revenue, who I'm sure are listening in the audience, to take these recommendations, or what is the intent?
Yeah, Representative McDonald, thank you so much for that. And the reason we heard this is because it had been one report that hadn't been heard. So I wasn't looking at specifically doing anything with the research tax credit, but certainly if bills would come forward. But I do think it lends just what you're saying itself to a larger discussion when on all of these tax expenditures that we don't know exactly what they're doing, and they're not under annual purview. And like you said, it could be if we found out that whatever credit X or deduction Y isn't doing its purpose, that it could be discontinued and put into use to provide very important tax relief for other areas. So I think it's the committee. I think we're open to anything and everything, but mainly we're just to hear this. I wasn't looking to necessarily do recommendations this year, but excuse me, if a member wanted to look at that, that's certainly we'd certainly entertain that, of course. Representative McConnell.
Mr. Chair, then with the follow-up, that is it with your recommendations, is there any kind of quantitative number that would show us that this would be a better investment? Is that impossible to really say?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, the short answer is no. I mean, we know how much is claimed in tax credit each year, so that's the cost of the credit. It was $55 million or so in the most recent year that we had data for. I don't know how it's changed in the subsequent years. So we know that. But how you would spend that $55 million in a different way is sort of what you're asking, I think. That's really the prerogative of you as the elected officials. But we did not examine any alternative use of that money, if that's what you're asking.
Very good. Representative McDonald?
Yeah, no, that's it. I know. It was a kind of a silly question, but it was more of a statement. You can see how big the state is. We have so many things going on. Oftentimes we don't know what's going, what money is going where, and it's quite convoluted, as you probably agree.
And like any program, as Representative McDonald's bringing, I mean, let's take the research tax credit. It probably has a very good intention, and maybe just improving it some would target it better and get better results. So it, you wouldn't have to revamp thing, but just target certain things and rather than totally throwing things away. But I just think, in that task force report back in 2011, it looked at kind of periodically looking at these various tax expenditures, and you can kind of choose various areas and start with them. And certainly that wouldn't be something you discuss every day here, but you could have a task force, members from the tax committee that could start looking at those things and bring back some recommendations and just maybe take small bites every year, so to speak, as you move on. So look forward, Representative McDonald, to actually let's talk, and maybe members from this committee, I know others have mentioned interest in that, and maybe we could form a sub-task force or committee that could take a look at some of these. So, Representative Leslegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of going off of what you said. Mrs. Howard, you said in your points that that this credit has no specific purpose and no analysis for effectiveness and not enough data to evaluate it. At a high level, isn't this true for most tax expenditures? And shouldn't we be thinking about these recommendations across the board?
Ms. Hauer.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, you're asking an auditor to give opinion on something that she hasn't evaluated, so that's very tough. But I think back to what Sean Williams said at the outset, and he too mentioned the fact that there are tax incentives in statute that do not have a purpose statement. So I trust what Sean said, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised to find many that do not have a purpose statement in statute. You can, as we did as researchers, make assumptions about what the purpose was, but maybe the purpose was something else altogether. Maybe it wasn't to increase jobs. Maybe it was to keep businesses in the state. So I don't know the answer to your question.
Representative Becker Finn. Excuse me, Representative Loeffler, you're next. And you're on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Howard. In your big report, you note that since 1995, Minnesota has always been much higher than average in R&D investments by our companies. And then if you look at your slide 6, you see that there's a dramatic 40% reduction in the credits claimed between 2012 and 2013. And yet in 2013, we still retained our standing as ninth in the country. And I'm wondering if you looked at all what was happening between 2012 and 2013 in our overall big economic market to see, what did employment drop dramatically in the fields that this is targeting when we had a 40% drop of claiming? It seems like we retained our national standing even though we had less investment. And I'm just wondering if you had a chance to look at that, or I'm not even sure why there was such a big drop there, but it seems like that's a point at which we could learn something.
Ms. Howell.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, we do know that there wasn't a drop in employment for the four major industrial sectors of C corporations that received the credit, because we looked at the growth there and compared it to the growth attributable to the research tax credit, and that's where we saw such a small percentage that could be of that growth that could be attributable to the research tax credit. So there wasn't a drop in employment in those sectors necessarily. There might have been, without looking back at the numbers, I couldn't tell you for a specific year, there may have been a drop. But when we were looking at over the period of time that the claimants received the credit and the effects that accrued to the state as a result of those, and then compared that against the state as a whole, there were increases. There was growth in both employment and earnings over that period.
Well, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just still would like to kind of better understand how you can have a 40% drop in the credit claimed and what the real impact of that was, or if there wasn't an impact because employment continued to grow in that section, that might say this really isn't a very effective tool at influencing things, because we should have seen some impact with that big of a shift.
I think that was more of a comment.
It was a comment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe Representative McDonald and I might agree on this, because it does seem like, you know, $50 million spent on something that we're not necessarily seeing a benefit from. There probably are more impactful ways we could spend that money. So my question, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So on page 37 of the full report, at the bottom it says Minnesota's research tax credit does not require all credit claimants to increase qualified research activity. So to me, that's saying it's research activity that would have maybe happening regardless. And so I'm wondering if, when we go back to that slide 13 and the number of jobs, are those just jobs that are connected to the credit, or, you know, are those new jobs from increased research activity?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative, on that chart, whatever the slide number was,
13.
Those are increases in a job year. So you're right that when we stated in the report that an individual company wouldn't necessarily have to increase the amount of research activity to get the credit, that's true. But that chart that showed the fiscal benefits of the research tax credit did represent growth increases.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, growth tied to the credit.
Ms. Howell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, exactly. Growth that's attributable specifically to the research tax credit.
Oh, thank you.
So I've got three on the list. I'm going to go to Representative O'Neill, who hasn't had a chance today. So,
thank you, and I do have to run to rules in a minute, so I appreciate that. I just wanted to speak quickly on the business side, on the corporation and partnership side, that something that the presenter said was really impactful to me, which was, sometimes the audit process costs them more than the tax credit. Why would we do that? So either we need to streamline the audit process and not make it so burdensome and so confusing, which I hear frequently from businesses that are in this space of trying to receive these credits. I mean, it just needs reform. If we're going to continue on, I think we need to figure out purpose and why are we doing this and a few other things. But more importantly, why would they even want to take a credit that they know will cost them more in the audit process to be compliant? So that's incredibly troublesome to me, being a former business owner kind of in this space. So, and talking to a lot of business owners in my district, I have a lot of manufacturing in my district. Some of the biggest in the state are either in or very close to my district, and they are hit pretty hard by these audits. It is... I don't want to use the word threatening, but it's close to threatening the businesses when revenue comes knocking. It's not a good environment. So that's the experience that my business owners are telling me.
Representative O'Neill, point well taken. So how much time do we have left?
Mr. Chair, I think revenue wants to respond to that.
Ms. Starr, you? We have 2.5 minutes, but yes, I think so. I think this would be good, and this might be it for the day. If other I know we have Representative Petersburg and Representative Fabian is. But Ms. Starr, thank you, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jenny Starr, Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Revenue. And I'll just speak briefly, Representative, to your question. I just want the committee to know that we work very closely with the OLA on this program audit report. And we did take their recommendations very seriously, including we did a lot to increase the information available on our website, in particular to make sure that businesses know the kinds of documents that we would be possibly requesting in any particular audit so that they can have the opportunity to make sure they're collecting that data as they're doing the research in hopes of helping the audit process, if an audit is selected, to move more smoothly. We know that since that additional specific content on our website went up, the visits to those pages have increased by about 80% from the prior year when that information was not available. During the work of this program, we were also invited by Medical Alley and by our partners at the Minnesota CPA Society to provide specific educational opportunities for businesses and their tax professionals. I remember being at the Minnesota CPA opportunity, and the room, I think, was 500-600 people were in the room for that. And to the extent those invitations continue to come to Revenue, we will certainly supply that education. And then on the timeliness of the audits, I just would like the committee to know that we've worked very hard to use resources like our virtual audit room to make it easier for businesses to provide the data that they have in whatever format they keep it to our auditors. And we've also worked very hard on those audit timelines. So during the program audit, it was reported that 49% in 2014 and 54% in 2015 audits in our corporate franchise tax division were completed in less than a year, which is well below our targeted goal. And I'm just happy to report to the committee that in 2018, where's my number? It's well over 80% of audits in the corporate franchise tax division were completed in less than a year. If folks have other questions for me at a later time, I'd be happy to help out with that information.
Thank you very much, Ms. Starr. And I know you're available if we need you to come back. So we're out of time. Representative Petersburg, is it something for Ms. Howard that?
But I can do it all.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, this is the $50 million expenditure for this credit, this incentive. I'm wondering if staff can put together for us a list that really outlines how many millions of dollars we spend in incentives across the board trying to attract businesses. Because my point is that, as we've heard, these things are incredibly expensive to administer, both on the side of the business and the state. Would we be better off just trying to create an environment where everybody, Representative Carlson talked about early in the meeting, about losers in what we may be doing. When we do these types of things, we're picking winners and losers. And if we have several hundreds of millions of dollars in tax incentives, would we be better off lowering marginal rates and letting everyone be a winner in a state of Minnesota that's not very business-friendly? Thank you.
Representative Fabian, thank you so much. And Ms. Howard, thank you so much to you and your staff for the wonderful research and for your presentation today. So
thank you, Mr.
Thank you. And members, thanks so much. We are adjourned.